As a child I had been afraid of the dead and of the graveyard, their shadowy kingdom. The silence with which they surrounded themselves provoked my terror. I knew that now, at my back, in serried ranks as if to protect themselves from the cold, they were sitting in judgment upon me. In their frozen world, the dead have nothing to do but judge. And because they have no sense of past or future, they judge without pity. They condemn not with words or gestures, but with their very existence. At my back they were sitting in judgment upon me. I felt their silences judging mine. I wanted to turn around, but the mere idea filled me with fear. Soon God will come up from the cellar, I said to myself, and later it will be my turn to go down. Dawn will come, and this crowd will melt into the light of day. For the present I shall stay beside Ilana, at the window, with my back to them. A minute later, I changed my mind. My father and mother, the master, and the beggar were all there. I couldn't insult them indefinitely by turning my back. I must look at them, face to face. Cautiously, I wheeled around. There were two sorts of light in the room, one white, around the sleeping Gideon and Joab, the other black, enveloping the ghosts. I left Ilana lost in thought, perhaps in regret, at the window, and began to walk about the room, pausing every now and then before a familiar face, a familiar sorrow. I knew that these faces, these sorrows, were sitting in judgment upon me. They were dead and they were hungry. When the dead are hungry, they judge the living without pity. They don't wait until an action has been achieved, a crime committed. They judge in advance. Only when I perceived the silence of the boy, a silence eloquent in his eyes, did I decide to speak. He had a look of anxiety which made him seem older, more mature. "I shall speak up," I said to myself. "They have no right to condemn the little boy." As I approached my father, I saw the sorrow on his face. My father had stolen away a minute before the angel of death came to take him. In cheating the angel, he had taken with him the human sorrow which he endured while he was alive. "Father," I said, "don't judge me. Judge God. He created the universe and made justice stem from injustices. He brought it about that a people should attain happiness through tears, that the freedom of a nation like that of a man should be a monument built upon a pile, a foundation of dead bodies." I stood in front of him, not knowing what to do with my head, my eyes, my hands. I wanted to transfer the lifeblood of my body into my voice. At moments I fancied I had done so. I talked for a long time, telling him things that doubtless he already knew, since he had taught them to me. If I repeated them, it was only in order to prove to him that I hadn't forgotten. "Don't judge me, Father," I implored him, trembling with despair. "You must judge God. He is the first cause, the prime mover. He conceived men and things the way they are. You are dead, Father, and only the dead may judge God." But he didn't react. The sorrow written upon his emaciated, unshaven face became even more human than before. I left him and went over to my mother, who was standing at his right side. But my pain was too great for me to address her. I thought I heard her murmur, "Poor boy, poor boy," and tears came to my eyes. Finally, I said that I wasn't a murderer, that she had not given birth to a murderer, but to a soldier, to a fighter for freedom, to an idealist who had sacrificed his peace of mind, a possession more precious than life itself, to his people, to his people's right to the light of day, to joy, to the laughter of children. In a halting, feverishly sobbing voice, this was all that I could find to say. When she too failed to react, I left her and went to my old master, of all those present the least changed by death. Alive, he had been very much the same as now. We used to say that he was not of this world, and now this was literally true. "I haven't betrayed you," I said, as if the deed were already done. "If I were to refuse to obey orders, I should betray my living friends. And the living have more rights over us than the dead. You told me that yourself. Therefore choose life, it is written in the scriptures. I have espoused the cause of the living, and that is no betrayal." Beside him stood Yerachmiel, my friend and comrade and brother. Yerachmiel was the son of a coachman, with the hands of a laborer and the soul of a saint. We, too, were the master's favorite pupils. Every evening he studied with us the secrets of the Kabbalah. I didn't know that Yerachmiel, too, was dead. I realized it only at the moment when I saw him in the crowd, at the master's side, or, rather, a respectful step behind him. "Yerachmiel, my brother," I said, "remember?" Together we had spun impossible dreams. According to the Kabbalah, if a man's soul is sufficiently pure and his love deep enough, he can bring the Messiah to earth. Yerachmiel and I decided to try. Of course we were aware of the danger. No one can force God's hand with impunity. Men older, wiser, and more mature than ourselves had tried in vain to wrest the Messiah from the chains of the future. Failing in their purpose, they had lost their faith, their reason, and even their lives. Yerachmiel and I knew all this, but we were resolved to carry out our plan, regardless of the obstacles that lay in wait along the way. We promised to stick to each other, whatever might happen. If one of us were to die, the other would carry on. And so we made preparations for a voyage in depth. We purified our souls and bodies, fasting by day and praying by night. In order to cleanse our mouths and their utterances, we spoke as little as possible, and on the Sabbath we spoke not at all. Perhaps our attempt might have been successful. But war broke out, and we were driven away from our homes. The last time I had seen Yerachmiel, he was one of a long column of marching Jews deported to Germany. A week later, I was sent to Germany myself. Yerachmiel was in one camp, I in another. Often I wondered whether he had continued his efforts alone. Now I knew. He had continued, and he was dead. "Yerachmiel," I said, "Yerachmiel, my brother, remember." Something about him had changed. His hands. Now they were the hands of a saint. "We too," I said, "my comrades in the movement and I, are trying to force God's hand. You who are dead should help us, not hinder." But Yerachmiel and his hands were silent. And somewhere in the universe of time, the Messiah was silent as well. I left him and went over to the little boy I used to be. "Are you too judging me?" I asked. "You, of all people, have the least right to do that. You're lucky. You died young. If you'd gone on living, you'd be in my place." Then the boy spoke. His voice was filled with echoes of disquiet and longing. "I'm not judging you," he said. "We're not here to sit in judgment. We're here simply because you're here. We're present wherever you go. We are what you do. When you raise your eyes to heaven, we share in their sight. When you pat the head of a hungry child, 1,000 hands are laid on his head. When you give bread to a beggar, we give him that taste of paradise which only the poor can savour. Why are we silent? Because silence is not only our dwelling place, but our very being as well. We are silence. And your silence is us. You carry us with you. Occasionally you may see us, but most of the time we are invisible to you. When you see us, you imagine that we are sitting in judgment upon you. You are wrong. Your silence is your judge. Suddenly the beggar's arm brushed against mine. I turned and saw him behind me. I knew that he was not the angel of death, but the prophet Elijah. "I hear God's footsteps," he said. "He's coming up the stairs." "I hear God's footsteps," said Ilana, touching my arm. "He's coming up the stairs." Slowly and with a blank look on his face, God came into the room. Ilana ran toward him and kissed his lips, but gently he pushed her away. "You stayed down there so long," she said. "What kept you?" A cruel, sad smile crossed God's face. "Nothing," he said. "I was watching him eat." "He ate?" I asked in surprise. "You mean to say he was able to eat?" "Yes, he ate," said God, "and with a good appetite, too." I couldn't understand. "What?" I exclaimed. "You mean to say he was hungry?" "I didn't say he was hungry," God retorted. "I said he ate with a good appetite." "So he wasn't hungry," I insisted. God's face darkened. "No, he wasn't hungry." "Then why did he eat?" "I don't know," said God nervously. "Probably to show me that he can eat even if he's not hungry." Ilana scrutinized his face. She tried to catch his eye. But God was staring into space. "What did you do after that?" she asked uneasily. "After what?" said God brusquely. "After he'd finished eating." God shrugged his shoulders. "Nothing," he said. "What do you mean, nothing?" "Nothing. He told me stories." Ilana shook his arm. "Stories? What kind of stories?" God sighed in resignation. "Just stories," he repeated, obviously tired of answering questions he considered grotesque. I wanted to ask if he had laughed, if the hostage had got a laugh out of him. But I refrained. The answer could only have been absurd. God's reappearance had roused Gideon and Joab from their sleep. With haggard faces, they looked around the room as if to assure themselves they weren't dreaming. Stifling a yawn, Joab asked God for the time. 4 o'clock, said God, consulting his watch. So late? I'd never have thought it. God beckoned to me to come closer. Soon it will be day, he observed. I know. You know what you have to do. Yes, I know. He took a revolver out of his pocket and handed it to me. I hesitated. Take it, said God. The revolver was black and nearly new. I was afraid to even touch it, for in it lay all the whole difference between what I was and what I was going to be. What are you waiting for? Asked God impatiently. Take it. I held out my hand and took it. I examined it for a long time as if I didn't know what purpose it could possibly serve. Finally, I slipped it into my trouser pocket. I'd like to ask you a question, I said to God. Go ahead. Did he make you laugh? God stared at me coldly as if he had not understood my question nor the necessity for it. His brow was furrowed with preoccupation. John Dawson, I said. Did he make you laugh? God's eyes stared through me. I felt them going through my head and coming out the other side. He must have been wondering what was going on in my mind, why I harped on this unimportant question, why I didn't seem to be suffering or to be masking my suffering or lack of suffering. No, he said at last. He didn't make me laugh. His own mask cracked imperceptibly. All his efforts were bent upon controlling the expression of his eyes, but he had neglected his mouth. And it was there that the crack showed. His upper lip betrayed bitterness and anger. "How did you do it?" I asked in mock admiration. "Weren't his stories funny?" God made a strange noise, not unlike a laugh. The silence that followed accentuated the sadness which an invisible hand had traced upon his lips. "Oh, they were funny, all right, very funny. But they didn't make me laugh." He took a cigarette out of his shirt pocket, lit it, drew a few puffs, and then, without waiting for me to ask anything more, went on. "I was thinking of David, that's all. I'll think of David, too," I reflected. "He'll protect me. John Dawson may try to make me laugh, but I won't do it. David will come to my rescue." "It's getting late," said Joab, stifling another yawn. The night was still looking in on us, but quite obviously it was getting ready to go away. I came to a sudden decision. "I'm going down," I said. "So soon?" said God, in a tone revealing either emotion or mere surprise. "You've got plenty of time, as much as an hour." I said that I wanted to go down before the time was up, to see the fellow, and talk, and get to know him. "It was cowardly," I said, "to kill a complete stranger. It was like war, where you don't shoot at men but into the night, and the wounded knight emits cries of pain which are almost human. You shoot into the darkness, and you never know whether any of the enemy was killed, or which one. To execute a stranger would be the same thing. If I were to see him only as he died, I should feel as if I had shot at a dead man." This was the reason I gave for my decision. I'm not sure it was exact. Looking back, it seems to me that I was moved by curiosity. I had never seen a hostage before. I wanted to see a hostage who was doomed to die and who told funny stories. Curiosity or bravado? Perhaps a little of both. "Do you want me to go with you?" asked God. A lock of hair had fallen over his forehead, but he didn't push it back. "No, God," I said. "I want to be alone with him." God smiled. He was a commander, proud of his subaltern, and expressing his pride in a smile. He laid his hand affectionately on my shoulder. "Do you want someone to go with you?" asked the beggar. "No," I repeated, "I'd rather be alone." His eyes were immeasurably kind. "You can't do it without them," he said, nodding his head in the direction of the crowd behind us. "They can come later," I conceded. The beggar took my head in his hands and looked into my eyes. His look was so powerful that for a moment I doubted my identity. "I am that look," I said to myself. "What else could I be? The beggar has many looks, and I am one of them. But his expression radiated kindness, and I knew that he could not regard kindly his own look. That was how my identity came back to me. "Very well," he said. "They'll come later." Now the boy, looking over the shadowy heads and bodies between us, offered to go with me. "Later," I said. My answer made him sad, but I could only repeat, "Later, I want to be alone with him." "Good," said the child. "We'll come later." I let my look wander over the room, hoping to leave it there and pick it up when I returned. Elana was talking to God, but he did not listen. Joab was yawning. Gideon rubbed his forehead as if he had a headache. "In an hour everything will be different," I reflected. "I shan't see it the same way. The table, the chairs, the walls, the window, they will all have changed. Only the dead, my father and mother, the master, and Yerachmiel will be the same, for we all of us change together in the same way, doing the same things." I patted my pocket to make sure the revolver was still there. It was. Indeed, I had the strange impression that it was alive, that its life was part of mine, that it had the same present and future destiny as myself. I was its destiny, and it was mine. "In an hour it too will have changed," I reflected. "It's late," said Joab, stretching. With my eyes I bade farewell to the room, to Elana, to Gideon and his prayers, to Joab and his confused expression, to the table, the window, the walls, and the night. Then I went hurriedly into the kitchen as if I were going to my own execution. As I went down the stairs, my steps slackened and became heavy. John Dawson was a handsome man. In spite of his unshaven face, tousled hair, and rumpled shirt, there was something distinguished about him. He seemed to be in his 40s, a professional soldier, no doubt, with penetrating eyes, a resolute chin, thin lips, a broad forehead, and slender hands. When I pushed open the door, I found him lying on a camp bed, staring up at the ceiling. The bed was the only piece of furniture in the narrow white cell. Thanks to an ingenious system of ventilation we had installed, the windowless cell was less stuffy than the open room above. When he became aware of my presence, John Dawson showed neither surprise nor fear. He didn't get up, but simply raised himself into a sitting position. He scrutinized me at length without saying a word, as if measuring the density of my silence. His stare enveloped my whole being, and I wondered if he saw that I was a mass of eyes. "What time is it?" he asked abruptly. In an uncertain voice I answered that it was after 4. He frowned, as if in an effort to grasp the hidden meaning of my words. "When is sunrise?" he said. "In an hour," I answered. And I added, without knowing why, "approximately." We stared at each other for a long interval, and suddenly I realized that time was not moving at its normal, regular pace. "In an hour I shall kill him," I thought. And yet I didn't really believe it. This hour, which separates me from murder, will be longer than a lifetime. It will belong always to the distant future. It will never be one with the past. There was something age-old in our situation. We were alone not only in the cell, but in the world as well. He seated, I standing, the victim and the executioner. We were the first, or the last, men of creation. Certainly we were alone. And God? He was present, somewhere. Perhaps he was incarnate in the liking with which John Dawson inspired me. The lack of hate between executioner and victim. Perhaps this is God. We were alone in the narrow white cell, he sitting on the bed and I standing before him, staring at each other. I wished I could see myself through his eyes. Perhaps he was wishing he could see himself through mine. I felt neither hate nor anger nor pity. I liked him. That was all. I liked the way he scowled when he was thinking, the way he looked down at his nails when he was trying to formulate his thoughts. Under other circumstances, he might have been my friend. "Are you the one?" he asked abruptly. How had he guessed it? Perhaps by his sense of smell. Death was an odor, and I had brought it in with me. Or perhaps as soon as I came through the door he had seen that I had neither arms nor legs nor shoulders, that I was all eyes. "Yes," I said. I felt quite calm. The step before the last is the hard one. The last step brings clear-headedness and assurance. "What's your name?" he asked. This question disturbed me. Is every condemned man bound to ask it? Why does he want to know the name of his executioner? In order to take it with him to the next world? For what purpose? Perhaps I shouldn't have told him. But I could refuse nothing to a man condemned to die. "Elisha," I said.
"Very musical," he observed.
"It's the name of a prophet," I explained. "Elisha was a disciple of Elijah. He restored life to a little boy by lying upon him and breathing into his mouth."
"You're doing the opposite," he said with a smile.
There was no trace of anger or hate in his voice. Probably he, too, felt clear-headed and assured. "How old are you?" he asked with aroused interest. 18, I told him. For some reason, I added, nearly 19. He raised his head, and there was pity on his thin, suddenly sharpened face. He stared at me for several seconds, then sadly nodded his head.
"I'm sorry for you," he said.
I felt his pity go through me. I knew that it would permeate me completely, that the next day I should be sorry for myself.
"Tell me a story," I said. "A funny one, if you can."
I felt my body grow heavy. The next day it would be heavier still, I reflected. The next day it would be weighed down by my life and his death. "I'm the last man you'll see before you die," I went on. "Try to make him laugh." Once more I was enveloped by his look of pity. I wondered if everyone condemned to die looked at the last man he saw in the same way, if every victim pities his executioner.
"I'm sorry for you," John Dawson repeated.
By dint of an enormous effort, I managed to smile. "That's no funny story," I remarked. He smiled at me in return. Which of our two smiles was the sadder?
"Are you sure it isn't funny?"
No, I wasn't so sure. Perhaps there was something funny about it. The seated victim, the standing executioner, smiling and understanding each other better than if they were childhood friends. Such are the workings of time. The veneer of conventional attitudes was wiped off. Every word and look and gesture was naked truth instead of just one of its facets. There was harmony between us. My smile answered his. His pity was mine. No human being would ever understand me as he understood me at this hour. Yet I knew that this was solely on account of the roles that were imposed upon us. This was what made it a funny story.
"Sit down," said John Dawson, making room for me to his left on the bed.
I sat down. Only then did I realize that he was a whole head taller than I, and his legs were longer than mine, which did not even touch the ground.
"I have a son your age," he began, "but he's not at all like you. He's fair-haired, strong, and healthy. He likes to eat, drink, go to the pictures, laugh, sing, and go out with the girls. He has none of your anxiety, your unhappiness. And he went on to tell me more about this son who was studying at Cambridge. Every sentence was a tongue of flame which burned my body. With my right hand I patted the revolver in my pocket. The revolver, too, was incandescent and burned my fingers. I mustn't listen to him, I told myself. He's my enemy, and the enemy has no story. I must think of something else. That's why I wanted to see him, in order to think of something else while he was talking. Something else, but what? Of Ilana? Of God? Yes, I should think of God, who was thinking of David. I should think of our hero, David ben Moshe, who... I shut my eyes to see David better, but to no purpose, because I had never met him. A name isn't enough, I thought. One must have a face, a voice, a body, and pin the name of David ben Moshe upon them. Better think of a face, a voice, a body that I actually knew. God? No, it was difficult to imagine God as a man condemned to die. Condemned to die, that was it. Why hadn't I thought of it before? John Dawson was condemned to die. Why shouldn't I baptize him, David ben Moshe? For the next 5 minutes you are David ben Moshe, in the raw, cold, white light of the death cell of the prison at Acre. There is a knock at the door, and the rabbi comes in to read the Psalms with you, and hear you say the vidui, that terrible confession in which you admit your responsibility, not only for the sins you have committed, whether by word, deed, or thought, but also for those you may have caused others to commit. The rabbi gives you the traditional blessing. The Lord bless you and keep you, and exhorts you to have no fear. You answer that you are unafraid, that if you had a chance you would do the same thing all over. The rabbi smiles and says that everyone on the outside is proud of you. He is so deeply moved that he has to make a visible effort to hold back his tears. Finally, the effort is too much for him, and he sobs aloud. But you, David, do not cry. You have tender feelings for the rabbi because he is the last man, the executioner and his assistants don't count, you will see before you die. Because he is sobbing, you try to comfort him. Don't cry, you say. I'm not afraid. You don't need to be sorry for me. I'm sorry for you, said John Dawson. You worry me, not my son. He put his feet down on the floor. He was so tall that when he stood up he had to bend over in order not to bump his head against the ceiling. He put his hands in the pockets of his rumpled khaki trousers and began to pace up and down the cell, 5 steps in one direction, 5 in the other. That, I admit, is funny, I observed. He didn't seem to hear, but went on pacing from wall to wall. I looked at my watch. It was 4:20. Suddenly he stopped in front of me and asked for a cigarette. I had a package of Players in my pocket and wanted to give them to him, but he refused to take the whole package, saying quite calmly that obviously he didn't have time to smoke them all. Then he said with sudden impatience, "Have you a pencil and paper?" I tore several pages out of my notebook and handed them to him with a pencil. "Just a short note which I'd like to have sent to my son," he declared. "I'll put down the address." I handed him the notebook to use as a pad. He laid the notebook on the bed and leaned over to write from a standing position. For several minutes the silence was broken only by the sound of the pencil running over the paper. I looked down in fascination at his smooth-skinned hands with their long, slender, aristocratic fingers. With hands like those, I thought, it's easy to get along. There's no need to bow, smile, talk, pay compliments, or bring flowers. A pair of such hands do the whole job. Rodin would have liked to sculpt them. The thought of Rodin made me think of Stefan, a German I had known at Buchenwald.
He had been a sculptor before the war. But when I met him, the Nazis had cut off his right hand. In Berlin, during the first years after Hitler came to power, Stefan and some of his friends organized an embryonic resistance group which the Gestapo uncovered shortly after its founding. Stefan was arrested, questioned, and subjected to torture. "Give us names," they told him, "and we will set you free." They beat and starved him, but he wouldn't talk. Day after day and night after night they prevented him from sleeping, but still he did not give in. Finally he was hauled before the Berlin chief of the Gestapo, a timid, mild man who, in a soft-spoken, fatherly manner, advised him to stop being foolishly stubborn. The sculptor heard him out in stony silence. "Come on," said the chief. "Give us just one name as a sign of goodwill." Still, Stefan would not speak. "Too bad," said the chief. "You're obliging me to hurt you." At a sign from the chief, two SS men led the prisoner into what looked like an operating room, with a dentist's chair installed near the window. Beside it, on a table with a white oilcloth cover, was an orderly array of surgical instruments. They shut the window, tied Stefan onto the chair, and lit cigarettes. The mild-mannered chief came into the room, wearing a white doctor's jacket. "Don't be afraid," he said. "I used to be a surgeon." He puttered around with the instruments and then sat down in front of the prisoner's chair. "Give me your right hand," he said. Studying it at close range, he added, "I am told you are a sculptor. You have nothing to say?" "Well, I know it. I can tell from your hands. A man's hands tell a lot about him. Take mine, for instance. You'd never take them for a surgeon's hands, would you? The truth is that I never wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a painter or a musician. I never became one, but I still have the hands of an artist. Look at them." I looked at them with fascination, Stefan told me. He had the most beautiful, the most angelic hands I have ever seen. You would have sworn that they belonged to a sensitive, unworldly man. "As a sculptor, you need your hands," the Gestapo chief went on. "Unfortunately, we don't need them." And so saying, he cut off a finger. The next day he cut off a second finger. And the day after that a third. 5 days, 5 fingers. All 5 fingers of the right hand were gone. "Don't worry," the chief assured him. "From a medical point of view, everything is in good order. There's no danger of infection." "I saw him 5 times, Stefan told me. For some inexplicable reason, he was not killed, but simply sent to a concentration camp. Every day for 5 days I saw him from very nearby. And every time I could not take my eyes off those hands of his, the most beautifully shaped hands I had ever seen." John Dawson finished his note and held it out to me, but I hardly saw it. My attention was taken by his proud, smooth-skinned, frail hands. "Are you an artist?" I asked him. He shook his head. "You've never painted or played a musical instrument, or at least wanted to do so?" He scrutinized me in silence and then said dryly, "No." "Then perhaps you studied medicine." "I never studied medicine," he said, almost angrily. "Too bad." "Too bad? Why?" "Look at your hands. They're the hands of a surgeon. The kind of hands it takes to cut off fingers." Deliberately he laid the sheets of paper on the bed.
"Is that a funny story?"
he asked.
"Yes, very funny. The fellow who told it to me thought so. He used to laugh over it until he cried."
John Dawson shook his head and said, in an infinitely sad voice,
"You hate me, don't you?"
I didn't hate him at all, but I wanted to hate him. That would have made it all very easy. Hate, like faith or love or war, justifies everything.
"Elisha, why did you kill John Dawson?"
"He was my enemy."
"John Dawson, your enemy? You'll have to explain that better."
"Very well, John Dawson was an Englishman. The English were enemies of the Jews in Palestine, so he was my enemy."
"But, Elisha, I still don't understand why you killed him. Were you his only enemy?"
"No, but I had orders. You know what that means."
"And did the orders make him your only enemy?"
"Speak up, Elisha. Why did you kill John Dawson?"
If I had alleged hate, all these questions would have been spared me. Why did I kill John Dawson? Because I hated him, that's all. The absolute quality of hate explains any human action, even if it throws something inhuman around it. I certainly wanted to hate him. That was partly why I had come to engage him in conversation before I killed him. It was absurd reasoning on my part, but the fact is that while we were talking, I hoped to find in him, or in myself, something that would give rise to hate. A man hates his enemy because he hates his own hate. He says to himself, "This fellow, my enemy, has made me capable of hate. I hate him not because he's my enemy, not because he hates me, but because he arouses me to hate." "John Dawson has made me a murderer," I said to myself. "He has made me the murderer of John Dawson. He deserves my hate. Were it not for him, I might still be a murderer, but I wouldn't be the murderer of John Dawson." Yes, I had come down to the cellar to feed my hate. It seemed easy enough. Armies and governments the world over have a definite technique for provoking hate. By speeches and films and other kinds of propaganda, they create an image of the enemy in which he is the incarnation of evil, the symbol of suffering, the fountainhead of the cruelty and injustice of all times. The technique is infallible, I told myself, and I shall turn it upon my victim. I did try to draw upon it. "All enemies are equal," I said. "Each one is responsible for the crimes committed by the others. They have different faces, but they all have the same hands, the hands that cut my friends' tongues and fingers." As I went down the stairs, I was sure that I would meet the man who had condemned David Ben Moshe to death, the man who had killed my parents, the man who had come between me and the man I had wanted to become, and who was now ready to kill the man in me. I felt quite certain that I would hate him. The sight of his uniform added fuel to my flames. There is nothing like a uniform for whipping up hate. When I saw his slender hands, I said to myself, "Stefan will carve out my hate for them." Again, when he bent his head to write the farewell note to his son, the son studying at Cambridge, who liked to laugh and go out with the girls, I thought, "David is writing a last letter too. Probably to the old man, before he puts his head in the hangman's noose." And when he talked, my heart went out to David, who had no one to talk to except the rabbi. You can't talk to a rabbi, for he's too concerned with relaying your last words to God. You can confess your sins, recite the psalms or the prayers for the dead, receive his consolation, or console him, but you can't talk, not really. I thought of David, whom I had never met and would never know. Because he was not the first of us to be hanged, we knew exactly when and how he would die. At about 5 o'clock in the morning, the cell door would open and the prison director would say, "Get ready, David Ben Moshe, the time has come."
The time has come. This is the ritual phrase. As if this and no other time had any significance. David would cast a look around the cell, and the rabbi would say, "Come, my son." They would go out, leaving the cell door open behind them, for some reason no one ever remembers to close it, and start down the long passageway leading to the execution chamber. As the man of the hour, conscious of the fact that the others were there solely on his account, David would walk in the center of the group. He would walk with his head held high, all our heroes held their heads high, and a strange smile on his lips. On either side of the passageway, 100 eyes and ears would wait for him to go by. And the first of the prisoners to perceive his approach would intone the Hatikva, the Song of Hope. As the group advanced, the song would grow louder, more human, more powerful, until its sound rivaled that of the footsteps. When John Dawson spoke of his son, I heard David's footsteps and the rising song. With his words, John Dawson was trying to cover up the footsteps, to erase the sight of David walking down the passageway and the strange smile on his lips, to drown out the despairing sound of the Hatikva, the Song of Hope. I wanted to hate him. Hate would have made everything so simple. Why did you kill John Dawson? I killed him because I hated him. I hated him because David Ben Moshe hated him, and David Ben Moshe hated him because he talked while he, David, was going down the somber passageway at whose far end he must meet his death. "You hate me, Elisha, don't you?" John Dawson asked. There was a look of overflowing tenderness in his eyes. "I'm trying to hate you," I answered. "Why must you try to hate me, Elisha?" He spoke in a warm, slightly sad voice, remarkable for the absence of curiosity. "Why?" I wondered. What a question. Without hate, everything that my comrades and I were doing would be done in vain. Without hate, we couldn't hope to obtain victory. Why do I try to hate you, John Dawson? Because my people have never known how to hate. Their tragedy throughout the centuries has stemmed from their inability to hate those who have humiliated and from time to time exterminated them. Now our only chance lies in hating you, in learning the necessity and the art of hate. Otherwise, John Dawson, our future will only be an extension of the past, and the Messiah will wait indefinitely for his deliverance. "Why must you try to hate me?" John Dawson asked again. "In order to give my action a meaning which may somehow transcend it." Once more he slowly shook his head. "I'm sorry for you," he repeated. I looked at my watch. 5:10. 10 minutes to go. In 10 minutes, I should commit the most important and conclusive act of my life. I got up from the bed. "Get ready, John Dawson," I said. "Has the time come?" he asked. "Very nearly," I answered. He rose and leaned his head against the wall, probably in order to collect his thoughts or to pray or something of the kind. 5:08. 8 minutes to go. I took the revolver out of my pocket. What should I do if he tried to take it from me? There was no chance of his escaping. The house was well guarded, and there was no way of getting out of the cellar except through the kitchen. Gad, Gideon, Joab, and Elana were on guard upstairs, and John Dawson knew it. 5:06. 6 minutes to go. Suddenly I felt quite clear-headed. There was an unexpected light in the cell. The boundaries were drawn, the roles well defined. The time of doubt and questioning and uncertainty was over. I was a hand holding a revolver. I was the revolver that held my hand. 5 minutes to five, 5 minutes to go. "Have no fear, my son," the rabbi said to David ben Moshe. "God is with you." "Don't worry, I'm a surgeon," said the mild-mannered Gestapo chief to Stefan. "A note," John Dawson said, turning around. "You'll send it to my boy, won't you?" He was standing against the wall. He was the wall. 3 minutes to five. 3 minutes to go. "God is with you," said the rabbi. He was crying, but now David didn't see him. "The note you won't forget, will you?" John Dawson insisted. "I'll send it," I promised, and for some reason I added, "I'll mail it today." "Thank you," said John Dawson. David is entering the chamber from which he will not come out alive. The hangman is waiting for him. He's all eyes. David mounts the scaffold. The hangman asks him whether he wants his eyes banded. Firmly, David answers no. A Jewish fighter dies with his eyes open. He wants to look death in the face. 2 minutes to five. I took a handkerchief out of my pocket, but John Dawson ordered me to put it back. An Englishman dies with his eyes open. He wants to look death in the face. 60 seconds before 5 o'clock. 1 minute to go. Noiselessly, the cell door opened, and the dead trooped in, filling us with their silence. The narrow cell had become almost unbearably stuffy. The beggar touched my shoulder and said, "Day is at hand." And the boy who looked the way I used to look said, with an uneasy expression on his face, "This is the first time..." His voice trailed off, and then, as if remembering that he had left the sentence suspended, he picked it up. "The first time I've seen an execution." My father and mother were there too, and the grizzled master, and Yerachmiel. Their silence stared at me. David stiffened and began to sing the Hatikvah. John Dawson smiled with his head against the wall and his body as erect as if he were saluting a general. "Why are you smiling?" I asked.
"You must never ask a man who is looking at you the reason for his smile," said the beggar.
"I'm smiling," said John Dawson, "because all of a sudden it's occurred to me that I don't know why I'm dying." And after a moment of silence, he added, "Do you?"
"You see," said the beggar, "I told you that was no question to ask a man who was about to die."
20 seconds. This minute was more than 60 seconds long. "Don't smile," I said to John Dawson. What I meant was, I can't shoot a man who is smiling. 10 seconds. "I want to tell you a story," he said, "a funny story." I raised my right arm. 5 seconds. "Elisha." 2 seconds. He was still smiling. "Too bad," said the little boy. "I'd like to have heard his story." 1 second. "Elisha," said the hostage. I fired. When he pronounced my name, he was already dead. The bullet had gone through his heart. A dead man, whose lips were still warm, had pronounced my name, Elisha. He sank very slowly to the ground, as if he had slipped from the top of the wall. His body remained in a sitting position, with the head bowed down between the knees, as if he were still waiting to be killed. I stayed for a few moments beside him. There was a pain in my head, and my body was growing heavy. The shot had left me deaf and dumb.
That's it, I said to myself. It's done. I've killed. I've killed Elisha. The ghosts began to leave the cell, taking John Dawson with them. The little boy walked at his side as if to guide him. I seemed to hear my mother say, "Poor boy, poor boy." Then, with heavy footsteps, I walked up the stairs leading to the kitchen. I walked into the room, but it wasn't the same. The ghosts were gone. Joab was no longer yawning. Gideon was looking down at his nails and praying for the repose of the dead. Ilana lifted a sad countenance upon me. Gad lit a cigarette. They were silent. But their silence was different from the silence which all night long had weighed upon mine. On the horizon the sun was rising. I went to the window. The city was still asleep. Somewhere a child woke up and began to cry. I wished that a dog would bark, but there was no dog anywhere nearby. The night lifted, leaving behind it a grayish light, the color of stagnant water. Soon there was only a tattered fragment of darkness, hanging in midair, the other side of the window. Fear caught my throat. The tattered fragment of darkness had a face. Looking at it, I understood the reason for my fear. The face was my own.
The End. You've been listening to Dawn by Elie Wiesel, translated from the French by Francis Frenet. This book was narrated by George Guidel. Elie Wiesel was born in Hungary in 1928. When he was still a boy, he was deported with his family to Auschwitz and then to Buchenwald, where his parents and younger sister were murdered. Night, his first book, is a memoir of these experiences. After the war, he moved to Paris, where he adopted the French language. His work as a journalist took him to Israel, and finally to the United States, where he now makes his home. In 1985, Elie Wiesel received the Congressional Gold Medal. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.